Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Rebecca Lavoie, in for Virginia Prescott. Say the name Joyce Maynard in a crowd, and you're likely to get some pretty visceral and varied reactions. From those who've admired her career since her beginnings as a reporter for the New York Times and her later syndicated column Domestic Affairs, and from her detractors, those who are highly critical of her relentless self-examination and her revelations about her affair with J.D. Salinger. Salinger was living as a recluse in Cornish, New Hampshire, when he began exchanging letters with Maynard after reading an article she wrote for the Times as a freshman at Yale. She dropped out of college and moved in with Salinger, living with him for 10 months. She was 18, Salinger, 53. In 1992, Maynard was living in Keene, New Hampshire, when her novel To Die For became a breakout hit. The book was based on New Hampshire teacher Pam Smarts conspiring with her students to murder her husband. It was later made into a film starring Nicole Kidman.
The way I remember, it was your plan all along. You and Jimmy, you had this crazy fixation about me, and you were getting some kind of perverted kick out of the whole idea, like people with your sexual problems tend to do.
Joyce Maynard's latest fictional take on true crime is the novel After Her. It takes place in Northern California in the late 1970s, with two adolescent girls living in the shadow of Mount Tamalpais in Marin County. There, a serial killer is on the hunt, raping and strangling women hiking on the mountain trails. Here's Maynard reading from the prologue of After Her, which speaks to the innocence of the girls and the dark things that are about to change their lives forever.
Nothing much ever happened on the mountain where we lived growing up. We were always hoping for a little excitement. So my sister and I made up situations. All we had was time. One day, we decided to see what it felt like to be dead. I had a red sweatshirt, the kind with a zipper up the front, and a hood and pockets to keep gum. I spread it out on a patch of grass on the hillside behind our house, with the sleeves stretched out as if they were a person who'd been run over by a truck, the hood off in a different direction, so as much of the red part showed as possible, like a pool of blood. "Lie there," I told my sister, pointing to a spot in the middle, over the zipper part. She might disagree, but Patty nearly always did what I told her. If she had questions, she kept them to herself.
That was Joyce Maynard reading from her novel After Her. Joyce Maynard, welcome to Word of Mouth and welcome back to New Hampshire.
Oh, I love being in New Hampshire, Rebecca.
Mount Tamalpais, a real place where you lived for a long time after you left New Hampshire. Can you describe it and what drew you there?
Well, I spent the first 42 years of my life in the state of New Hampshire and decided when my kids got older to broaden our horizons. And I went as far west as I could, which was the Bay Area of California. And I drove over the Golden Gate Bridge and saw this mountain. It's, to people who know the White Mountains or certainly the Sierras, it's not a particularly distinctive one, but it rises out of nowhere. And I was just drawn to take that exit. In my odd way, I went to a real estate open house the next day on that mountain, because it was on that mountain, and bought the house that I visited. And it was a kind of a crazy thing to do. I've done a few of those, I guess, in my life. And I have lived there for 17 years, and it's on that mountain that I wrote this book. And every morning of my life living in that house, I would look out at this big black rock, basically, facing me like a freight train coming closer. But it wasn't for some time before I learned the history of one particular event that had taken place there, or a series of them.
After Her, it's based on true events. David Carpenter, known as the Trailside Killer, he raped and murdered at least five people on the trails around the very mountain where you moved. Talk about how you became interested in the case. How did you hear about it?
Well, everybody who lives out there is aware of that case. It took place in 1979 to 1981, but people who lived there then will still bring it up. But it didn't become personalized to me until I host writing workshops at my home, and two women now in their 40s showed up for a one-day class in memoir, which is what I love to teach. And it turned out that they were the daughters of the homicide detective who had been in charge of that investigation. And they were still, over 30 years later, very haunted and shaped by the experience of growing up in the shadow of those killings, and in particular, what those killings had done to their father. It was one particular thing that the older of the two sisters, Laura, said to me that really made me sort of made my alarm bells go off. She said that she had just recently, within the last few years, she had written a letter to the Trailside Killer, who's still on death row in San Quentin, to ask to come and see him. And she went to see him. Their father had died shortly after the arrest of the killer, and he had never confessed, and she really believed that it was these killings, this series of murders, that had destroyed her father. And she wanted to look him in the eye and see if she could find any resolution. She didn't.
Well, you fictionalized the story. This isn't the first time you've done that. To Die For was a breakout hit for you based on the Pam Smart case. Many of the details of the actual crimes you write about, the real life crimes, do end up in the fictionalized version, but the fictional part, the part that you bring to it, is usually a lot closer to home. What kinds of stories do you like exploring when you look at these crimes?
You know, I hardly even know anymore what really happened, because after you work on a novel for a few years, you know, the facts of the real case and the story you create kind of blur. It isn't so much that the story reveals to me, oh, that would be interesting, as that story seemed to touch on themes and obsessions that have been with me always. At the core, one of them certainly is adolescence, and the adolescence, the vulnerability of a young girl in particular. And we hear a lot about young boy coming of age adventures, but I was really moved by the picture of two girls who are very much sort of raising each other. Their parents have divorced, their mother's kind of checked out, their father is consumed by this case, and although they adore him, he's a very flawed and deficient father. So they're sort of left to their own devices. And they decide that they are going to, or the older sister decides, with the magical thinking of a 13-year-old, that she is going to help her father solve this case. She sees the case destroying him, and she sets herself up to be bait for the killer. It is a drama constructed by a 13-year-old girl with all of the magical thinking and craziness of somebody who, you know, who uses a Ouija board.
One of my favorite parts of the book is when you write about sort of the human condition of a 13-year-old girl. I'm hoping you can read a bit of that.
Sure. 13-year-old girls live in two different worlds. They exist like citizens of two distinct countries. And though these two places are as different as Croatia is from New Guinea or Mercury from Saturn, they float between the two as effortlessly as a person might from one side of the Golden Gate Bridge to the other. Partly, a 13-year-old girl is still a child, capable of finding joy in setting grass on fire in a tin can, or thrill in the sight of a neighbor answering the ring of the doorbell and opening the door to discover no one there, only a rustle in the bushes. 13-year-old girls can actually believe that the reason they won't get to marry John Travolta is because he's got a girlfriend already, and that Peter Frampton's getting a haircut qualifies as a tragedy, and that receiving a call from a particular boy, or a particular girl, for that matter, is the most wonderful thing that ever happened. 13-year-old girls believe in heroic fathers and wicked stepmothers. They believe the words to songs and the advice of other 13-year-old girls, and that the first boy they love, they will love forever.
That's Joyce Maynard reading from her novel After Her. It's a book based on a series of real-life killings committed in the late 1970s in Marin County, California. That excerpt was describing the mindset of the narrator, a 13-year-old named Rachel who tries to set a trap to catch the killer in order to help her dad, who's a homicide detective. Joyce, 13, what is it about that age that so fascinates you?
It's so vulnerable. It's just such a tender, poignant time for me, because a young girl at that age, and I remember this from my own age 13 and from my daughter's, is right in the middle of, there's a big part of her that's still a child. I still had Barbies when I was 13. But she's also, now more even than in 1979 where my novel was set, she's also thrust into the world of adult sexuality. And this was heightened by the experience of these particular girls, because there is this very dark and twisted sexual landscape that is right behind their house. And there is, you know, something that could be sort of beautiful and tender is very ugly and scary.
The novel also explores themes of sisterhood, the relationships between parents and children, and divorce. You've written quite a bit about your own divorce over the years. And then I think in this book in particular, the thing that struck me, I recently listened to an episode of The Moth that you recorded several years ago, where you talked about trying to create a sort of perfection for your kids in the wake of divorce. And it plays out very differently here. As you mentioned, the mom is checked out. The dad is, you know, kind of a mess, really wrapped up in this case. knowing that that perfection doesn't work, is this your way of sort of playing out different scenarios?
Absolutely. You got it. I mean, it's one of the haunting, you know, the themes that has just, you know, obsessed me over the years, the desire to create this happy family. I came from a really interesting, inspiring family. I loved both my parents deeply, but I idealized those families, those perfect-looking families on television, and I wanted to be part of one of those. And these girls, actually, there's a scene early on in the book when they're looking at the Brady Bunch, also through a TV window. Their family is so broke, they don't have cable anymore, they don't get TV, but they look through the picture window of their neighbors and watch the Brady Bunch and wish that that was them. And of course, what I know now, and it took me way too many decades to figure this out, is that it's a lie, that perfect family. The reality is that all of our lives are, we're all stumbling along trying to figure it out the best we can, and I'm much kinder and gentler on myself, I think. But in my days as a young single mother in my 30s and early 40s when my kids were growing up, I desperately felt a desire to sort of make it match other people's families and make it save them pain. Now I'd say that it's pain that contributes to our compassion and strength. And there's no protecting children from that. All you can do is make them strong enough to handle it.
You are one of those writers that people have often talked about and written about, but a lot of the conversation isn't about your writing. It's about Joyce Maynard, the person. Would you flip that if you could?
Well, you know, and I have to say I brought that a lot of that on myself because I write about myself. And I don't do it because I regard myself as the most fascinating character around. But I'm the character that I know best. I'm the only one that I really have any business talking about in quite such an intimate way. And I have to say I don't find it a problem doing that. I grew up in, I mentioned, an alcoholic family where we didn't talk about what was going on. So I have this deep commitment to talking about the truth, just saying it, naming it. It's always, what's the worst that can happen? If you talk about what's really happening, it's my experience, you know, if children are afraid of a monster under the bed, the best thing to do is look under the bed, turn on the lights and look under the bed. But I've written some pretty self-revealing essays and a memoir that certainly, you know, a lot of people criticize me for. The one single word that has most consistently been used is, and it's so interesting to me that this would be the word, is shameless. And I'd say, yeah, I that's what I'd wish for my children. Let them be shameless, unless there's something that they've done that they should be ashamed of. I hope that writing the way I do allows other people, especially women, to forgive themselves, their flaws. If I talk about mine, they're suddenly not alone anymore. I felt very alone growing up.
I'm wondering if the advice you would give to women writers who aspire to follow in your footsteps, is it accept that kind of criticism and scrutiny or rail against it?
You know,
what would you suggest?
I learned a powerful lesson. I used to try to please. I used to really look for my sense of who I was by what the world told me. And I was a good girl for a lot of years. When I published At Home in the World, the memoir that brought a shower of, not even criticism, condemnation down on me, it was hard to find a critic who said anything good about me. And it wasn't even the book. It was me, very personally. What I feel now is I am not going to take my sense of identity from what somebody else tells me about myself. I know who I am, and neither will I if somebody says I've, you know, written the most brilliant book ever. I hope I won't be pulled in that direction either. I know what I am and what I am not. I wrote an essay that was published a couple of days ago in the Wall Street Journal. It was about the story that I told was how when my marriage was falling apart and I was looking for some comfort somewhere, and I used to do this odd thing if I would go to little towns in New Hampshire and I would go look at, I'd go to a real estate open house or even, you know, ask a realtor to show me some house. I was not buying a house. I didn't have the money to buy a house, but I would walk through these houses and just sort of imagine a different life. And I published this piece that was about that and about some other things. And I got this, I've been criticized for a lot of different things, but this was a new one. This angry man writing to say to me, you are exploiting real estate agents. So, you know, you can't win. Is that going to ruin my day? I'll live with that one.
Joyce Maynard, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Shadows go so long before my eyes.
Joyce Maynard's new novel is After Her. We've posted links to reviews of the book and some of her recent columns about Mount Tamalpais and adventures in real estate at wordofmouthradio.org. Maynard's memoir, At Home in the World, is being re-released this fall. There's also a new book and documentary on Salinger coming out next month. I asked Joyce if she was interviewed for the top secret film. She was. And I also asked how she feels about her Salinger revelations leaving an indelible mark on her career. You can listen to that part of our conversation by going to our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. There's more Word of Mouth coming your way in just a minute. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Rebecca Lavoy in for Virginia Prescott. Grocery stores have made big news in recent months, from the closing of several large chains in New Hampshire to the battle for corporate control at regional favorite Market Basket. But whether you peruse Price Chopper or shop at Shaw's, you've probably instinctively checked produce for bruising or blemishes or put aside a can of soup because it was dented. On the flip side, there are many people willing to eat for free what paying customers will not, even if they have to dig through a dumpster to find it.
You know, don't be afraid to grab the yogurt. Don't be afraid to grab the sushi. Don't be afraid to grab the cheese. If you hesitate just a second, it's gone.
New Hampshire native Alex Malice is head of Analect Films and the director of the short documentary Spoils, Extraordinary Harvest. The film follows a diverse group of so-called dumpster divers on their late-night journey to an alternative food source, the alley behind a New York City Trader Joe's. I spoke to Alex this spring about the philosophy and logistics behind reclaiming discarded food from the dumpster. Alex, you followed several different dumpster divers in your film. What qualities or beliefs did they share, and how were they different from one another?
They actually came from quite a wide range of political or apolitical beliefs. You know, a lot of people associate dumpster diving with this so-called freeganism, which is a fiercely political ideology that sort of speaks to the idea that by living off the excess of society, you're making a political statement about the waste that we generate. Almost all the people I followed, they didn't explicitly talk about that, and they were more just interested in the free food. They were saying, hey, if there's free food, you know, I want it.
What about their income levels? Are these all people who need to get free food, or are these people who could be buying groceries?
Yeah, every single person, both in the film and people that I met that didn't appear on camera, could certainly get by without this free food. There, you know, I actually didn't really come across any homeless people or people who couldn't otherwise survive. And beyond that, you know, the income levels were quite diverse. There was people who were on, you know, certainly on the lower end of the income level, and there was people who certainly had a lot of money.
One of the people you follow really defies stereotype. He's clean cut. He has a nice apartment. Here he is showing the camera just a few of the treasure food products he's found in a dumpster.
Pasta from Italy. This is my walnuts. Beautiful cashews. Just like a dent in the can. This is the finest Dijon mustard I've ever had in my life. Wild Alaskan salmon. This I got last night. This is a nice find. It's got a crack in it. It's sea salt, peanut butter.
When you see this food in a pantry and away from a trash can, it's hard not to acknowledge what a waste it would have been to throw it all away. I have that very container of sea salt, for example, in my pantry. What are people sacrificing, though, when they eat this food from dumpsters?
I think the biggest sacrifice is time, actually. In the film, it's all sped up. You know, the film is only 20 minutes long, and you get this whole process summarized. But in reality, you have to leave your home at 10:30 p.m. and you get out there, and you might end up waiting around. It's not exact, and then you have to actually do the dumpster diving, which could take 30, 40 minutes. Then you have to go home, and then you have to wash it, and the whole process can take 4 or even 5 hours, depending on the kind of night. You know, as opposed to going to the grocery store where you're in and out and you pick what you want and that's that, it's actually quite a lot of time.
It is nighttime when everybody that you follow in the film finally collects in front of a New York City Trader Joe's. Can you describe the typical dumpster diving session? How many people were there? What time of day is it? All that stuff?
It really depends on the store, and this is constantly changing. There's really no golden rule, but generally it's after hours. 30 minutes after the store closes, they'll gather their, you know, the day's trash, and they'll bring it out. This usually happens around 11 p.m., sometimes midnight. It can look like, oh, nobody's here tonight. But then as soon as these dumpsters are rolled out, 20 people come out of the woodwork, you know, out of cars, around the corner, you know, descend from helicopters. It's like they come from everywhere, and suddenly there's 20 or 30 people there.
Oh. types. Zed. Oh, we got tomatoes and
blueberries and strawberries.
No, these are the, what's the name of
them?
I know that. They're like oranges. Get me the bag. No, they're red, the green bag. On the front.
Oh, there's more potatoes.
That one, that one. That has something in? Okay, so here. Mandarins, yeah.
You know, one of the characters in the film sort of describes it as a free-for-all, and in many ways it is, but it's also very, for the most part, it's a very egalitarian process. People are sort of like, ooh, you know, okay, here's a bag of potatoes, I'll take what I need, and then sort of announce, does anybody need any potatoes? Or, oh, here's, you know, in the film some guy says, oh, cat food, but I don't have a cat. Does anybody want this? You know, despite the fact that I think people come from quite different backgrounds. You know, there's people who I've seen there who don't even really speak English, or there's people, you know, these hipsters or these grandmothers and young people and middle-aged people, and no one really makes small talk, but they all sort of understand that they're there for the same reason, and there's this excitement that we're all doing something amazing, something secret, and something a little under the radar that we're all benefiting greatly from. And it's like, it's almost like a big joke. You know, you pull out these high-end organic, you know, packaged foods, and you're saying, what the hell, look at this. This is like, you know, I just pulled out a $20 hunk of cheese, and I'm just going to take this for free.
Oh, there's so much cheese!
Okay, I'm here.
All right, what do you want, double cream French?
No,
cheddar. Pita bread, oh, cheddar. Hold on, let me get you cheddar.
We should probably mention that in the film it is acknowledged that Trader Joe's is the best spot to dumpster dive, in contrast to, I think he mentions Key Foods as being the place that you don't necessarily want to go. And during the actual dive at Trader Joe's, somebody says to another diver, if the fish isn't cold, don't eat it. Did you hear about anybody getting sick from the food they were pulling from the dumpster there?
Well, first, yes, Trader Joe's is sort of the best place. And it's the general rule to follow is the higher end the grocery store, the higher end their trash is. So, yes, Key Foods, Associated Market, these are sort of the lower end grocery stores in New York City. And generally the stuff they throw away should probably be left to be thrown away. But these places like Trader Joe's, Whole Foods, some of these smaller niche markets, they throw away some amazing stuff. And that's generally the place to go. Trader Joe's is so beloved because of the variety. You know, some places will just have bread, just produce, just this or that. Bakeries will have desserts, but Trader Joe's will have everything from eggs to produce to sea salts to, you know, spices to meats to sometimes beer I've even come across. I've actually never heard of anyone getting sick at all. Generally, the food that's thrown away is either at or past the expiration date by just one day. Some of the packaged foods have just a tear in them, or one of the eggs in the carton has cracked. A glass bottle has broken and spilled its contents over all the other glass bottles, and rather than just clean them up, they put them out. And yeah, you know, there's it's just common sense. It's no science. If something is molding, you don't eat it. If something, you know, stinks, like if something's rotting, you don't take it. And you know, I've never had any problems with getting sick or anything like that.
Alex, what about your habits? Do you dumpster dive? Have you tried any of this food?
Absolutely, and that's how I ended up making this film. You know, I was dumpster diving quite a bit. I think it was for almost 2 years before I even picked up the camera. I heard about it from a friend, and I said, you know, really? That's incredible. I got to see this for myself. And I went there, and sure enough, on the first day, I came home with $100 worth of high-end organic food. From then on, I was eating like a king.
Alex Malice is head of Analect Films, as well as the director, photographer, and editor of the documentary Spoils, Extraordinary Harvest. I spoke to him this spring about the film, and you can watch it online right now. I recommend it. We've posted the video on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. The 2013 NFL season kicks off in a couple of weeks, with defending Super Bowl champion Baltimore Ravens taking on the Denver Broncos on September 5th. The game will give fans the first opportunity in months to get together, warm up the couch, and yes, bust out the beer and snacks. Sabra Hummus is making a play to sit alongside chicken wings, nachos, and salsa in the billion-dollar-plus football food market. And it's got a big backer. Sabra Hummus is now the official dip of the NFL. Now, this might not sound like a big deal here in the Northeast, where the Middle Eastern spread is already popular. Hummus is still something of a foreign food to large swaths of football-watching America. Duane Stanford is a reporter for Bloomberg News, and he spoke with Virginia Prescott about hummus's attempt to score a touchdown with fans of football.
Duane, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
So hummus is the official dip of the NFL. Now, where on earth did that come from?
Yeah, well, Sabra has been making a push in the U.S. For some time now. They hooked up with PepsiCo back in 2007, and you've probably noticed it pop up in grocery stores all over the place. Well, part of that is trying to figure out a way to get more people to try hummus, because it's this weird kind of chickpea concoction that a lot of people just aren't used to. So one of the ways to do that is to try to get people to bring it to their Super Bowl parties and eat it at football watching parties. So tie in with the NFL, they think, is one way to do that.
Who makes the decisions when it comes to NFL snack sponsorships anyway? I mean, PepsiCo is obviously a big player. Is this purely a financial transaction?
Yeah, I mean, these are sponsorship deals. So it's, you know, the NFL getting together with various corporations who want to push their products. And so really it's sort of a designation in order to get your name out there and get you tied in with a specific thing.
Football foods tend to have not so subtle masculine qualities, you know, the spiciest chicken wings, nachos with spicy salsa on them. Isn't hummus a little chick food-like?
Yeah, that's a good point. I was actually kind of tickled myself when I saw some of the commercials that they were running now where people were dipping chicken wings in hummus. That may take a little time to get that sort of taste going. I guess the idea is to, in some ways, surprise people and, you know, ask them to look at hummus in a way that they perhaps haven't before. One of the keys that they're trying to do is to get people to expand how they use hummus. Right now, you have folks who dip it with chips and things like that. What they hope to do is at stage two, as the CEO of Sabra, Ronan Zohar, says, he wants people to actually spread it on toast and bagels. And then the third step after that is to get people to eat it as a side item, sort of the way they might eat mashed potatoes. And it's the way that you'll find people eating it in the Middle East.
I'm trying to think of another example of a company that has successfully rebranded a foreign food for the American market. Anything come up for you?
Well, you know, this follows the pattern in some ways of Greek yogurt. This was, you know, people ate yogurt a lot here, just the same way they eat lots of salsa and different dips in the U.S. You took something from the Middle East and you pointed out the fact that some of the Middle East diets, the Mediterranean diets, are healthier and, you know, better ingredients. It's a thicker, kind of different yogurt that's also kind of weird because it's sour and much thicker than people are used to. So it took a little time for people to get used to it. But once they did, it became a big business and it moved very fast. So that's what they're hoping will happen with hummus across the country.
That's Duane Stanford with Bloomberg News. We posted a link to his article on hummus, the new official dip of the NFL, at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, what do you think? Will your friends mind if you swap out the onion dip for hummus this football season? Let us know on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio. Coming up, remembering Elmore Leonard's rules of prose. We'll cut out the adverbs when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Rebecca Lavoie, in for Virginia Prescott. Elmore Leonard was best known for his action-packed crime novels and westerns. Critics, fellow writers, and readers fell in love with Leonard's memorable characters and snappy dialogue, both of which have jumped countless times to screens, big and small.
You awake?
Yeah, I'm now.
Since when do you sleep in your clothes?
Couldn't figure out a way to keep a gun in my undershorts.
Since when do you sleep with a gun?
Since I found out the woman I've been seeing has a husband I couldn't knock down with a hammer.
That's a scene from the FX TV show Justified, based on Leonard's novella Fire in the Hole. Elmore Leonard passed away this week at the age of 87. In 2007, Elmore Leonard spoke in Portsmouth as part of the Writers on a New England Stage series, a co-production of NHPR and the Music Hall. He dug deep into his process of writing and researching books like Road Dogs, Get Shorty, and Up in Honey's Room, which had just been published.
I'm going to open with the first paragraph of a review of Up in Honey's Room, which appeared in Newsday, I think yesterday. And it said, "There are lots of different ideas about what makes a writer great, but among them has to be the ability to make the line, 'Have you ever been to Cleveland?' sound seductive." And I didn't know it was that seductive. Because when I started writing the book, my original title was Hitler's Birthday. And I thought that was a terrific title. And all my friends liked it, too. Hitler's Birthday, yeah. April the 20th. Then, of course, I told my editor, and she said, "Hitler's Birthday?" She said, "Hitler doesn't sell." "Not anymore. You have to think of something else." She said, "If we were to send your book to bookstores or announce the fact that your new book is Hitler's Birthday, the bookstores would cut their orders in half or even more than that." Well, I'm anxious to sell books. I would like to have as many readers as I can. So I said, "All right, I'll change the title." And I changed it to Honey originally was Helen. So I thought Up in Helen's Room is, you know, it needs a little more. So I changed her name to Honey, Up in Honey's Room. And then I thought, maybe I should end the book Up in Honey's Room. At least let's fulfill the title. And that happens. Everybody in the book, I think just about everybody, is up in Honey's Room for the big finish. And it is, I think it's a big finish. I never know how my book is going to end. I don't want to know because I make it up as I go along. And I like to sit down at my desk in the morning and I have an idea for a scene. I know what the next scene is, but I'm not sure yet whose point of view it should be told from. And that's important to me because I want to remain out of the book. I don't want you to be aware, the reader, of my sound. I want the sounds of the characters to prevail. So I'm always writing from a character's point of view. And the character might not be grammatical. You know, he might not be grammatically correct all the time. But I don't want proper usage necessarily to get in the way of the sound of the story. Because that's the way I think of my books as the writing, as a sound. It's a lot of fun to write it. In fact, all my books are fun to write because I never know what they're going to be about. Because I begin with characters and develop their attitudes and how they oppose one another, how they get along, how they fall in love, how they do whatever they do. And with that in mind, the first 100 pages or so, I don't have too much trouble. Then I get into the second 100 pages and it becomes a little more difficult and I have to begin to plot a little bit. And I don't like to plot. I wish I could just begin with an idea, with a terrific idea that you're dying to read, and I would just sit back and write it. But I don't do it that way. I don't begin with the idea. I begin with the characters. I begin with characters in situations and how they work themselves in and out of whatever the situations are. For example, Chisholmingo Blues, I thought, guy dives off the top of an 80-foot ladder. I thought, what? He sounds like a pretty interesting guy. Let's find out about him, see what he does, you know. So I asked my researcher to see if he can find some high divers somewhere. So he found them. They were in the Florida Panhandle. We went down to talk to them. They were putting up the ladder at that time. And that evening, they put on their show. We got to talk to them, have dinner with them, and find out what they thought and, you know, what kind of guys they were. So I developed a story about a high diver who's been diving for quite a while, and he sets up at a casino, gambling casino in Mississippi, where he will put on his act twice a day. And then I found out, though, that that's all he does. He just dives. So then I have to bring some other Dixie Mafia in. I have to bring the bad guys in. I have to bring, you know, other characters in. So that's all right. It's part of making it up as I go along. And then finally getting to a certain point where I have to think of how to end it. But there are always multiple ways to end it. Right now, I'm writing a book, and I'm going to feature Jack Foley, who is in Out of Sight. Jack Foley is a bank robber. I thought, I want to use Jack Foley again because George Clooney played him. And Foley was one of George Clooney's favorite characters. And so my agent told him that I'm writing another Jack Foley, and Clooney thought that was a great idea, that I could come out and talk to him anytime I wanted. Of course, I didn't have anything to talk to him about. So I got him out of prison. And I didn't want him to escape again. He had already escaped once. He had to get out free and clear. So he appeals the 30 years, and it's reduced to 2.5 years with time served. So he gets out, and I thought, now, who's the woman? Well, there's one I like very much. Her name is Dawn Navarro, and she's a psychic. We'll see what happens with her. But I think she and Foley, I see, getting together to make money. Then I think, who's the bad guy? Well, I like Kundo Rey, who is in La Brava. And Kundo Rey was a Cuban who came to the United States when Castro opened the prisons and let all the bad guys come to Miami for their vacation. And Kundo Rey, I had a lot of fun with because he was a go-go dancer. He painted whiskers on his face and wore a little leopard skin jock strap. And he danced go-go, sometimes in gay bars, but more often in clubs for ladies' night. Ladies' night, the ladies would slip their tips into his jock strap. And he was funny, but he also killed people. He had killed a few people, but I liked him a lot. And I thought, he was funny. And I thought, I hope he's still alive. So I opened La Brava toward the end, and Joe La Brava shoots him in the chest 3 times. And I thought, oh, God. But Joe La Brava had to get out of there for whatever was going on in the story. He couldn't wait to, you know, feel a pulse or anything. He just left. So there was the opportunity. It's funny how I'm writing this now. You know, that's why I can talk about it more. It's with me right now. But I liked him. I liked all my characters. I have an affection for all of them, even the bad guys who I can't help it. I mean, they can't help the way they are. They're either just dumb or lazy or, you know, they want to cut corners. They want to make a lot of money. And it's okay with me. I can feel sorry for them that they're that way. I don't know how this book's going to turn out, but I think it's going to be good. And I'm hoping George Clooney will love it, because then we'll get something going. The only thing I have going right now in the movie business, well, actually, a couple of things. One, Kill Shot, a book that I wrote, 10 years ago maybe. Kill Shot was developed by John Madden, who directed Shakespeare in Love. And he wanted to remain true to the book. And he remained so true to it that the test audience weren't sure what was going on. Because in a book, I could suddenly send people out to Cape Girardeau, Missouri, and you know that what's happening in the book, the reason. But in the movie, it just didn't quite work. So next Tuesday, John Madden is going to come to Detroit, and I'm going to be home for a couple of days, and he's going to show me the movie, because he wants me to be pleased, which is unheard of in Hollywood, that the director would be anxious for the guy who wrote the book, not the screenplay. The book wants him to be pleased. Well, I'll be pleased. I know I will, because I like John Madden a lot. But I also would like to touch on this evening my rules for writing, which I came up with in the year 2000 when I was the guest of honor at the BoucherCon, which is a gathering of mystery writers and crime writers. And we all met in Denver, and I had to give a talk, so I thought, why don't I give a little talk on my rules, which I would make up that afternoon. But rules that I had in mind, of course. At that time, they were sort of tongue-in-cheek. But they're not entirely tongue-in-cheek because they've caught on. There are people, there are journalists especially, who tell me those rules should be up on the wall in the city room, every city room, because they're true, they're accurate. So about a year later, the New York Times had a column going, Writers on Writing. And they said, would you do something for us? And I said, all right, I'll do my rules now, and I'll elaborate on them and, you know, fill them out so that maybe they'll even make more sense than originally. So I wrote my rules. There are only 10 rules because, you know, 10 is a good number for rules. So I call this my 10 rules for success and happiness writing fiction. These are rules I picked up along the way to help me remain invisible when I'm writing a book, to help me show rather than tell what's taking place in the story. If you have a facility for language and imagery and the sound of your voice pleases you, invisibility is not what you are after, and you can skip the rules. Still, you might look them over. The first rule, never open a book with weather. If it's only to create atmosphere and not a character's reaction to the weather, you don't want to go on too long. The reader is apt to leaf ahead looking for people. There are exceptions. If you happen to be Barry Lopez, who has more ways to describe ice and snow in his book Arctic Dreams than an Eskimo, you can do all the weather reporting you want. Avoid prologues. They can be annoying, especially a prologue following an introduction that comes after a foreword. But they're ordinarily just found in nonfiction. A prologue in a novel is backstory, and you can drop it in anywhere you want. There's a prologue in John Steinbeck's Sweet Thursday, but it's okay because a character in the book makes the point of what my rules are all about. He says, I like a lot of talk in a book, and I don't like to have nobody tell me what the guy that's talking looks like. I want to figure out what he looks like from the way he talks. Figure out what the guy's thinking from what he says. I like some description, but not too much of that. Sometimes I want a book to break loose with a bunch of hoop-de-doodle. Spin up some pretty words, maybe, or sing a little song with language. That's nice. But I wish it was set aside so I don't have to read it. I don't want hoop-de-doodle to get mixed up with the story. All right. Number three. Never use a verb other than said to carry dialogue. The line of dialogue belongs to the characters. The verb is the writer sticking his nose in. But said is far less intrusive than grumbled, gasped, cautioned, lied. I once noticed Mary McCarthy ending a line of dialogue with, she asseverated, and had to stop reading and get the dictionary. Never use an adverb to modify the verb said, he admonished gravely. To use an adverb this way, or almost any way, I say is a mortal sin. The writer is now exposing himself in earnest, using a word that distracts and can interrupt the rhythm of the exchange. I have a character in one of my books tell how she used to write historical romances full of rape and adverbs. And those books, those historical romances always had a lot of adverbs and exclamation points. Rule number five, I say, keep your exclamation points under control. You are allowed no more than two or three per 100,000 words of prose. If you have the knack of playing with exclaimers the way Tom Wolfe does, you can throw them in by the handful. He just has fun with them. Never use the words suddenly or all hell broke loose. This rule doesn't require an explanation. I have noticed that writers who use suddenly tend to exercise less control in the application of exclamation points. Use regional dialect, patois, sparingly. Once you start spelling words in dialogue phonetically and loading the page with apostrophes, you won't be able to stop. Avoid detailed descriptions of characters, which Steinbeck covered. In Ernest Hemingway's Hills Like White Elephants, what do the, quote, American and the girl with him, end of quote, look like? She had taken off her hat and put it on the table. And that's the only reference to a physical description in the story. And yet we see the couple and know them by their tones of voice, with not one adverb in sight. Don't go into great detail describing places and things, unless you're Margaret Atwood and you can paint scenes with language, or write landscapes in the style of Jim Harrison. But even if you're good at it, you don't want descriptions that bring the action, the flow of the story, to a standstill. And finally, try to leave out the parts that readers tend to skip, which may be the most important rule. This rule came to mind in 1983. I was having lunch at Book of the Month Club, and someone asked me a question. How do you do whatever it was, the question? And I said, well, I try to leave out the parts that people skip. And everybody thought that was funny, so I included that in my rules. Although I had not read, I hadn't written my rules yet. Think of what you skip reading a novel. Thick passages of prose you can see have too many words in them. What the writer is doing, he's writing, perpetrating hoop-de-doodle, perhaps taking another shot at the weather, or has gone into the character's head, and the reader either knows what the guy's thinking or doesn't care. I'll bet you don't skip dialogue. And my most important rule is one that sums them all up. And if it sounds like writing, I rewrite it. It's my attempt to remain invisible.
That was author Elmore Leonard speaking live in Portsmouth as part of the Writers on a New England Stage series in 2007. He died this week at the age of 87. After the news of Leonard's death broke, writers took to social media in droves to express their condolences and to post Elmore's 10 Rules of Writing, published as a column in the New York Times in 2001. When author and essayist Joyce Maynard sat down with me earlier this week, I read her a few of Leonard's rules of writing and asked Joyce Maynard if she wanted to share any of her own.
I never have formally made a list, but I'm certainly very familiar with mine because I teach writing. And one is, I believe in clarity. I believe in simplicity and clarity. I can write a flowery, elaborate sentence as well as the best of them, I believe. I've been doing this a long time. I'd better be able to. But to what end? Why should I say something in 25 words that could be said in six? My mother used to say, and my mother really was my first and best teacher of writing, write as if every word cost a nickel, because she said this long ago. So I say to my students, write as if every word cost $5 and think very hard about spending that money. But a period is free.
You can listen to the full 2007 broadcast of Writers on a New England Stage with Elmore Leonard at wordofmouthradio.org. We've also posted a link to Elmore Leonard's Rules for Prose on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in today. We invite you to share your own ideas about writing, pop culture, tech, or anything else by sending us a tweet or posting on our Facebook page. I'm Rebecca Lavoie, and this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Zach Nugent,
and Bill Barry.
And senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with plenty of help from our interns,
Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon.
Sarah Plord is our digital producer.
And Dan Colgan runs our board.
The views expressed in this program
are those of the individuals,
not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows, go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr.
Follow us on Twitter.
And check out a playlist of music from the program
on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public
Radio.